This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Just ahead, we hear what's in store for the second annual Funk Festival in Kinston next weekend. Beaufort is the quintessential small seaside town with boutiques, award-winning seafood restaurants, and maritime recreation. Its ties to Blackbeard and wild horses that roam Carrot Island make Beaufort memorable, earning the title America's Favorite Town by Travel and Leisure magazine. Beaufort has its challenges, though. One struggle the town officials and marine scientists are addressing, the occasional flooding that occurs during heavy rain events, and what happens when stormwater flows from here into here.
And the water that it flows into is a big recreational resource and is also a big fishing resource. So the effects matter to a lot of people right away.
Dr. Mike Peeler is a professor at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City.
So our project is focused on stormwater, and stormwater carries with it a bunch of different things, including human pathogens, including nutrients, including sediments, and all those things have different health and environmental effects.
Beaufort has been proactive in addressing stormwater issues in recent years, including development of a watershed planning process and cleaning out and maintaining drainage ditches. Planning Director Kyle Garner says the town also adopted a stormwater fund that puts money into improving and maintaining existing infrastructure, as well as creating new rain gardens and bioretention areas to help deal with runoff.
Not everything that drops here goes into the water bodies. Some of it is absorbed back into the ground, and that's why we've encouraged more landscaping facilities.
Stormwater that discharges into coastal waters can have a negative impact on human and ecosystem health. Perhaps you've seen the rainbow-colored oil sheen on the road after it rains. This, along with other contaminants like lawn fertilizers or even waste from leaky septic tanks, can end up draining into nearby waterways. Professor at the Institute of Marine Sciences, Dr. Rachel Noble, says a number of factors, such as aging infrastructure and development, make Beaufort susceptible to stormwater entering Taylor's Creek, which runs parallel to the waterfront.
We have the unpredictability of the storms. In the meantime, we have periods of time that we have higher than normal tides. And so when we have those really high tides, all the people that live along here in Beaufort and along Front Street, they know that they see floods, because if it's raining and the water used to flow out of the streets into the ocean, but now the ocean is essentially pushing back, there's nowhere for that stormwater to go. And there are periods of time in the streets of Beaufort that we can have, in certain areas, a foot, 2 feet, and even more of water.
The height of the groundwater table also has an impact on how quickly stormwater is absorbed. Dr. Noble says during periods of heavy rain, less space is available for stormwater to soak into the ground.
So we're not in a drought period right now. We're in kind of the opposite. We're in a high groundwater table right now. And so there's very little space for that stormwater to infiltrate.
Even though Beaufort has focused on implementing stormwater mitigation strategies, Planning Director Garner admits more work needs to be done. The town is participating in a 3-year study in partnership with marine scientists to examine how stormwater flowing from Beaufort impacts the Rachel Carson Reserve, which includes Carrot Island, Town Marsh, Bird Shoal, and Horse Island. Dr. Noble is the lead investigator for the collaborative project that involves multiple marine science organizations, including the Rachel Carson Reserve, North Carolina National Estuarine Research Reserve, and the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences.
We will characterize the water quality, particularly during storms, coming from the town, and that water basically moves past the Rachel Carson Reserve, where people swim, fish, they recreate, they paddleboard, they're kayaking. So people are in the water and they want it to be clean.
To better understand how stormwater affects estuarine systems, 6 sampling locations have been set up at known sources of major stormwater discharge along Front Street and Beaufort, 2 of which are at the intersections of Orange Street and Gordon Street.
And those stormwater outfalls, or those pipes, are those that are immediately facing the reserve. So they're the most proximal to the reserve.
Another site which serves as the control is located farther away from Beaufort. Dr. Peeler says they're also employing new water sampling technology, a free-floating device called a hydrosphere that moves with the water currents.
Stormwater is often assessed at a single point, so when it comes out of a stream or when it goes into an estuary. But knowing what's going on at that point, while valuable and a lot better than nothing, is not as valuable as knowing how the effects change as it travels through the body of water.
One of the aims with the project is to create predictive models for shellfish and recreational waters in the reserve. Dr. Peeler says this information will be useful to officials who make the determination to close waters to swimming or shellfishing because of contamination.
So is it safe for people to swim? Is it safe for people to take oysters? This project hopefully will contribute a great deal to that directly. And it also will contribute to our understanding of how not only human health, but environmental health is affected by stormwater.
In addition to identifying stormwater problems for the town, Dr. Noble says they will also make recommendations on how to address the issues.
Of the problems that exist in the town of Beaufort, like flooding, like standing water, like contamination in the streets or contamination in certain areas, we will be able to help them prioritize what those problems are so that they can begin to tackle the most important ones. If we don't prioritize them, then any town is left with a litany of problems, and they don't really know how to select one over the other in terms of importance.
This guidance is something Planning Director for Beaufort, Kyle Garner, says is helpful due to the town's unique stormwater challenges.
They bring some expertise to the table that we don't have in improving the water quality. But by doing so, they also bring expertise in the engineering on how we may be able to work on some areas and retrofit them.
Beaufort isn't the only town that's focused on better managing wastewater. There are other projects in Dare County, Atlantic Beach, Wrightsville Beach, and Wilmington, all areas that are experiencing growth. Coastal researchers agree. The collaborative stormwater project in Beaufort serves as a model to other municipalities to help balance development with conservation. Once again, Dr. Peeler.
It's a big question these days looking at urban coasts because so many people want to live near the coast. And if your place is like we are here and you have wonderful water quality and lots of intact habitats, we think it's worth the effort to try and balance the two.
Dr. Peeler expects to have quantifiable results from the monitoring sites by the end of summer. And by year's end, they'll have a better sense of how stormwater impacts the coastal reserve and the magnitude of any potential human health risks. Scientists will continue to collect and monitor the 7 testing sites for the next year. This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the 2nd Annual Funk Festival happening in Kinston on Friday, May 26th and Saturday, May 27th. The festival documents and preserves the achievements and roles of African Americans in the development of Lenoir County. Today, Mac McKee speaks with chairperson of the African American Heritage Commission of Kinston and Lenoir County, Jerry Barbour, about the event next weekend.
Thank you so much for being our guest today.
And thank you for inviting me.
When it comes to the Funk Festival, what artists from North Carolina will you be highlighting?
Well, this is the 2nd year of our festival. We started last year with one of the major artists in this area, and that was Maceo Parker. He played with James Brown, and he was instrumental in the establishment of funk as an important music genre. This year, we are going to pay tribute to Dick Knight, who also played with James Brown and other known musicians. Many of the musicians who are responsible for the development of funk live in eastern North Carolina or were from eastern North Carolina, and some are still in the Kinston area today. And they are Sonny Bannerman, Wilbert Croom, Clemmy Fig Jones, Clark Tutt, Ira Wiggins, and Marvin Wiggins, just to name a few.
As far as some of the acts that will be performing at the festival, can you give us a rundown of a few of them?
Well, let me say that the festival is going to be for 2 days, Friday, May 26th, and Saturday, May 27th. And on Friday, starting out in the morning, although most of the festival is emphasizing music, Friday morning we are going to emphasize history. And at the Atkin High School, we will have a display of the history of funk and how it was developed, and it will be explained by Dr. Earl Imes, who is the curator at the North Carolina Museum of History. In tandem, we will have a discussion about the silent walkout that was done by the students at Atkin High School in 1952. And let me say that Atkin High School was a black high school back in the days of segregation, and unfortunately, unfortunately, as we all know, the schools were not equal, and there were many things that Adkin High School needed that were not provided by the Board of Ed. And so the students requested that they get a new gymnasium after it burned down, and that they would get some of the other things that they needed. But the Board of Ed said they couldn't afford to give them those things. And so that's why the students walked out silently, to let them know that indeed they felt that they were entitled to these things. So that will be discussed by Dr. Rita Joyner, who is a researcher and historian. So that's Friday morning. Friday evening from 5 to 8, we will have a talent showcase in the African American Music Trail Park. And there will be local talent that evening. Minister Natasha Matthews, Malik Turner, Lizette Carnegie, the Souls of Joy, a well-known quartet, the Majestic Mimes, the Kinston High School Jazz Band, and the Glamour Girls, a dance group. Also, Lafayette Jones will perform.
That sounds like a very big lineup. Now, in addition to music, on Saturday, you'll be having a marketplace fair. Now, where will that be, and what time will it begin?
That's Saturday morning from 10 to 1 on the campus of Adkin High School, and there will be exhibitions, and people will be distributing materials and so on, selling their wares, as it were, things that they have made, pictures they have painted, photographs that they have taken. And then Saturday night is the gala occasion. We will pay tribute to Dick Knight for his contribution to the development of the funk genre. And we will also have Milton Bullock, who was a lead tenor with the original Platters. So a lot of people are interested in coming out to hear him. We can dance the night away with the music of Tyrone Jefferson and A Sign of the Times.
It was around 250 people you had last year. What are the expectations for participants this year?
Well, we're expecting about 300 people.
Well, it sounds like that you've got a very busy weekend planned. Jerry, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for this opportunity. It's so meaningful to us.
This is the Down East Journal. A burgeoning industry in the state is butting up against state law, and the industry is fighting back. After a provision in a House bill that would have allowed small craft breweries to distribute on their own up to 200,000 barrels of their product rather than the current 25,000 was removed from the bill, two Charlotte brewers have filed a lawsuit against the state, saying that the law that forces craft brewers to deal with a distributor if they want to sell more than 25,000 barrels of their product is unconstitutional. It's a lawsuit that will be watched by a continually growing number of craft brewers in the state. A Durham couple has been following how quickly the industry is growing, so quickly that they faced a unique problem in their publishing efforts. George Olson has this, which originally aired in August 2016.
Eric Lars Myers and Sarah H. Fickey have what would typically be a devastating problem for authors. They no sooner publish a book and it's out of date.
Even when we hit 45 breweries in the first book, that book was six or eight breweries out of date by the time it even got published a few months later. We have something similar that actually happened with this book. We finished writing it in December, and now there are 176 breweries in the state. So there are almost as many breweries that have opened since we finished writing this book in December as there were in the first book.
Eric Lars Myers talking about the first two editions of North Carolina Craft Beer and Breweries. The first edition came out in 2012, and as just mentioned, was out of date when it hit stores. This year's second edition profiles 136 breweries and brew pubs around the state, and 40 more have opened over about 8 months' time. Craft breweries are now just starting to take off in North Carolina, propelled by the arrival in 1980 of a German immigrant to the Outer Banks region.
So he was really important because when he came to North Carolina, he came because he was in farming. And when he came to North Carolina, he had this vision of starting up a business like the ones that they had in Germany, where you have a farm that's also a brewery. And when he looked into it, he discovered that it was illegal because the laws that we had were still left over from post-prohibition, essentially. And so people who were producing beer were not allowed to sell it on their own premises. And he thought that this was pretty backwards. And so he basically realized that right around when he was doing this, that wineries had just passed a law in the Senate, in the House in North Carolina, that allowed them to have a restaurant on premises because they wanted to be able to make wine and also have people consume it there. And so what he did is he took that bill and he essentially just went through and crossed out winery and put in brewery. And then he took it back to the legislature and said, hey, you know, here's this bill. I want to get this passed. And it was the same thing that they had just looked at. So they looked at it again and said, yeah, that looks fine. And so he actually got the law changed so that people could make beer and also sell it to people to consume on their premises. And that allowed him to open up Weeping Radish.
Co-author of North Carolina Craft Beer and Brewery, Sarah Fickey, talking about Uli Benowitz, whose arrival in 1980 ultimately brought action in the state legislature in 1985, followed by his first brew pub, Weeping Radish, in 1986. Sarah notes it's not the first big moment in beer history for eastern North Carolina. Christoph von Graffenried arrived in what would become New Bern in 1710. The Swiss nobleman soon wrote a relation in Germany requesting equipment for one thing he found missing in the New World.
That was the earliest mention of brewing in the state of North Carolina that I could find when I was doing my research. And I love it because it was another German immigrant who did the same thing Uli did and wrote home and said, somebody please send me equipment to brew with because there's no beer here. And in his case, his wife knew how to brew. And so he asked them to send him equipment and they did.
All that history and the work of Uli Benowitz didn't prompt a flood of craft brewers in the state. 15 years after Benowitz's advocacy, only 28 breweries were active in the state. That's when the next great moment in North Carolina beer history occurred, the passage of the Pop the Cap legislation in 2006 that raised the legal alcohol limit for beer.
You know, it sounds a lot like, you know, let's make sure we can all get drunk, but that's really not what it's about. It's really about a breadth of styles and the ability to make a wide array of beers. So 6% alcohol just doesn't have enough range to be able to allow people to make a wide range of, say, Belgian offerings or even German offerings or English offerings. And there's just a lot of variety to be had there. So, you know, there were breweries in North Carolina and they were making really great beer. I think what the real stumbling block is that you didn't have a very excited drinking base at that point. So the customers were not really excited about the variety that was available to them. And when the cap got raised, what you had was a lot of breweries from out of state who were not distributing into North Carolina, who all of a sudden saw North Carolina as a viable distribution alternative. Because if you're a brewery in Michigan or Pennsylvania or something like this, and you have, you know, six beers that you make, and three of them are over 6% alcohol, and three of them are under 6% alcohol, you won't distribute any of them to North Carolina because it's just not worth distributing if you can't distribute your whole portfolio. So for a lot of people who were outside of the state, it just made a lot more sense to not distribute until an entire portfolio was available. And that, I think, brought in a lot of options and variety into the marketplace and got drinkers very excited, which meant that having a brewery here doing a wide array of offerings was a much more viable business.
Still, craft brewers didn't suddenly overflow the North Carolina market. Pop the Cap passed in 2006. By 2010, the number of breweries had crept up from 28 in 2000 to 48. And shortly after Eric and Sarah published their first edition of North Carolina Craft Beer and Breweries in 2012, the number of breweries was only in the 50s. That's more an indication of the fact breweries are not overnight startups. You want to start a brewery? Don't quit your day job, at least for a while.
Well, I think Pop the Cap was definitely the catalyst. It's what certainly set everything into motion. And, you know, you got to think that, yes, we're only seeing a really big explosion over the past few years, but it takes a long time to start a brewery. You're usually talking 3 to 5 years between coming up with the idea and actually getting equipment set up and brewing. You know, 5 years is a probably generous idea of how long it takes to start one of these businesses. So a lot of this has started over the past decade and is just sort of coming to fruition now.
And Eric Lars Myers further notes an evolution in government thinking about breweries, from prohibition in the early 20th century to state legislation making a craft brewery economically viable to outright courting of brew pubs.
overall, you see a lot of local governments realizing that breweries are really good for economic growth, and so a lot are trying to attract breweries no matter how they can, giving them tax abatements or in some cases even offers of free rent in buildings just to get something going on. I know Warren County was looking for a brewery for a long time. Greenville has been actively looking to find a large brewery to move in there. People really recognize that breweries have become drivers of economic growth. They're a good source of jobs, and of course they're a good source of tourism, and so they bring people into your town to see the town, you know, that they wouldn't necessarily be going there for.
And local breweries aren't just local in the sense they exist in your town. Eric and Sarah say local brewers can come pretty close to producing beer with 100% in-state grown items. Barley is grown and malted in-state, though a consistent source of local hops is still a problem. But the biggest single ingredient in any beer is water, and as most craft brewers don't have access to giant water processing facilities, Eric says, you're using your local town's water, so it makes it taste like your local town's water. Just as more restaurants are taking advantage of what their region produces, brewers are recognizing where they're from, putting them firmly in a trend of moving away from a one-size-fits-all mentality that predominated the food and beverage industry for decades.
And frankly, I think we see America going from this great homogenization in the 1950s to the 1970s, in which the pinnacle of food or, you know, achievement in food was making a hamburger that tasted the same way on both coasts, ignoring the fact that America really is this great tossed salad of people, and everybody everywhere has their own particular tastes and wants in terms of the food that they create and the climate that they're living in. And what we're really seeing now is a food economy and a drink economy that's reflecting the actual society that we are, rather than this idea of homogenization.
Eric Lars Myers and Sarah Fickey of Durham are the authors of the second edition of North Carolina Craft Beer and Breweries, published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.
Today on the Garden Journal, horticulture agent for Onslow County, Lisa Rayburn, shares from the heart on the benefits of gardens growing in unexpected places.
I spent last weekend in Baltimore with my brother. He's undergoing a stem cell treatment to try and control his cancer. I stayed with him during a portion of his treatment, and my role was to make sure he was doing okay, had food to eat, and help get him back and forth to the hospital for his appointments. Each morning, I would leave the apartment and cross the sky bridge that attached our building to the Johns Hopkins Hospital. I was instantly attracted to the gardens that greet visitors at the entrance to the hospital. Despite the urban environment, I recognized some of my favorite native plants, including redbud trees and witch hazel, as well as some classic landscape plants like Japanese styrax and ornamental grasses. I found myself relaxing, breathing more deeply as I stopped to see what other plants I could identify. Three times a day, I would cross the sky bridge on my own or with my brother. Some days we would make a lap or two of the hospital before we headed to the cancer center for checkups or chemo. Other times, I would walk on my own to stretch my legs before heading back to the apartment. With each lap around the hospital, I found a new plant or garden, and each time I did, it brought me a little peace and serenity. The Johns Hopkins Hospital complex is comprised of several buildings connected together, and tucked between the buildings are gardens in small, protected spaces. In these areas, the foliage softens the hard edges of the brick buildings and the walls of glass windows. These gardens provide many opportunities for patients, families, and medical workers to find solace in a little piece of nature. One particularly challenging morning, I turned a corner to find a pieris, a small ornamental shrub, tucked in a small planting bed just beside the escalator. Meeting this plant in such an unexpected place was like running into an old friend far from home. It lifted my mood and soothed my soul at the same time. Another favorite spot for me was a glass-walled corridor in front of the cafeteria. This corridor flanked a planting of birch trees, which were underplanted with ferns, hostas, and pansies. This little garden gave me the impression that I was walking through the woods, even though I was in the main corridor in the middle of a busy hospital. One morning, when we had the time and John had the energy, we enjoyed sitting on a patio in the fresh air. Plants like lavender rosemary, roses, and magnolia were growing. These are plants that have historically been associated with healing. Not all of the gardens were elaborate, but that didn't make them any less effective. It's not a surprise that the gardens brought me, a self-described plant nerd, peace during a difficult time. But gardens and hospitals provide quantifiable health benefits. Studies have shown that patients with a bedside view that looked out on leafy trees actually healed faster, needed significantly less pain medication, and had fewer post-surgical complications than patients whose view looked out on a brick wall. And other studies have shown that just 3 to 5 minutes spent looking at a view dominated by trees, flowers, or water can help reduce anger, anxiety, and pain while inducing relaxation. Researchers have been able to see measurable changes in indicators like blood pressure, muscle tension, and heart and brain electrical activity. I hope that you will never need the solace of a hospital garden, but I'm grateful to see that hospitals around the nation are starting to understand the value that gardens and landscapes provide to their patients, caregivers, and employees.